Parsha Parshas Vayikra. I want to say over Dvar Torah today that from Rav Salvatia Sal, the Rav, it's printed up in Reflections of the Rav, Volume 2, the first essay. It's also printed up partially in the biography of Rav Salvatia called the Rav, and that you have in front of you.
I have several reasons why I want to say this Dvar Torah today.
Okay. Rav Salvatia started with two questions that one can raise about Yaakov. Number one, the Medrash in Parshas Vayikra several times refers to Yaakov as the old man, Yisrael Saba, the old man, Hazaken Saba. Now, this is striking because Yaakov did not live as long as Avram and Yitzchak. So, Yaakov wasn't as old as Avram and Yitzchak. You don't find the Medrash emphasizing Avram was an old man, Yitzchak was an old man. The Medrash emphasizes over and over again that when Yaakov was learning Torah with Menashe and Ephraim, and when Yaakov was living in Mitzrayim, he was an old man. So this is a kasha I'm shot in the Medrash. Why the emphasis on Yaakov being the old man? Yisrael Saba. Question number two, which is a minor question, is that the name we're given as Jews is B'nai Yisrael. So why are we called B'nai Yisrael and not B'nai Avram, B'nai Yitzchak? Why do we choose Yaakov's name to be our name, as opposed to Avram Yitzchak? I call that a minor question because it has a simple answer. The simple answer is that if we call up an Avram and Yitzchak, it's not very precise because Avram had Yisrael, Yitzchak had Esau. So we call B'nai Yisrael because all B'nai Yisrael are B'nai Yisrael, we're the Jews. And if you say B'nai Avram and Yitzchak, you're including the Gosim Goyim as well. So any question which has a simple answer is a minor question. But we'll see that maybe the Rav felt there was a deeper reason as well why we're given the name B'nai Yisrael and as opposed to Avram Yitzchak. So to answer these questions, Rav Salvatia explained as follows. He pointed out as follows. Yaakov Avinu was the first, the only of the Avos, to have a long, extensive, powerful, deep relationship with his grandchildren. Yaakov Avinu was the only of the Avos, the first of the Avos, the only of the Avos, to have a long, deep, powerful, extended relationship with his grandchildren. Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, and he spent 17 years learning with Menashe and Ephraim. Now, the Medrash says that Avram learned with Yaakov when he was young. There, that in no way means that it was the same as with Yaakov and his grandchildren. He went with Yaakov till he was 13, and the Medrash never implies that Avraham was the Baal Masorah of Yaakov. After 13, then Yaakov stayed kosher and Esau went off the Derech. If someone asks you, who was Yaakov's main Rebbe? Who was his Baal Masorah? The answer is Yitzchak, Hashem Be'eder. It wasn't to Avraham. But for Menashe and Ephraim, Yaakov became their Baal Masorah. And to such a degree, that Yaakov makes an incredible, halachic, hashkafic, almost existential pronouncement about Menashe and Ephraim. What does Yaakov say about Menashe and Ephraim? Menashe and Ephraim kid, Ruvein Shimon Yehudi. Like my kids. Yaakov Avinu makes Menashe and Ephraim into his children, halachically, existentially, they're like his children. He becomes their Baal Masorah, he makes them into his children. Yaakov was able to, Rav explained, bridge the generation gap. Sometimes people, when they're older, can't relate to their grandchildren so well, or they have the time, or they have the ability. Yaakov, as an old man, was able to fully connect with you. When you're someone's Rebbe, when you're someone's Baal Masorah, it's much more than just a transmission of knowledge. It's a transmission of a way of life, and it's connecting on a personal level. And you discuss things, not just learning, you discuss everything about your lives, and you form a union. You form a Masorah union with the person you're teaching. So Yaakov was able to do that, not only with his children, but also with his grandchildren. So Yaakov Avinu was So therefore, Yaakov Avinu experienced the Masorah fully, not only for one generation, but for two. Yaakov Avinu experienced the Masorah fully, not only for one generation, but for two. With this, the Rav thought you could answer the two questions we started with. Why does the Medrash emphasize that Yaakov is an old man? Why does it point it out three or four times? Exactly this idea. The Medrash wants to emphasize that even as an old man, Yaakov was still an active member of the Masorah. That's exactly what was unique. What was special? What was different about Yaakov's life in Mitzrayim versus Yaakov's life in Eretz Yisrael? In Mitzrayim, Yaakov was an active member of the Masorah. When he was old, he was almost dying, he was old. In those last 17 years, he wasn't on the downhill. In those last 17 years, he was an active, vibrant member of the Masorah community, just as he had been when he was teaching his children Torah earlier. So to emphasize that point, the Medrash says, points out Yaakov, the old man, Yisrael Sabi, the old man. And so this might also explain why we call it B'nai Yisrael, because Yaakov becomes the ultimate symbol of Masorah. More than Avraham, more than Yitzchak. Of course, Avraham and Yitzchak experienced the Masorah, but more than the other Avos, Yaakov becomes the ultimate symbol of the Masorah. So since the essence of Yaakov is Masorah, our job in life basically is we receive Torah and Torah ideals and a Torah way of life from our teachers and our parents, and our job in life is to pass it along to the next generation. That's called Masorah. That's what Yaakov is all about. So maybe in order to emphasize that Yadus means Masorah, the Rav said maybe that's why, another reason why we chose Yaakov's name as our name, B'nai Yisrael. We're the B'nai Masorah. So the name we chose of the Avos is the one of the Avos who most powerfully symbolizes or represents the concept of Masorah. There's a Gemara in Tainus that Rashi quotes on the Chumash that says, Yaakov Avinu lo meis, Yaakov never died. So the Gemara says, Yaakov never died. He says, no, but he was embalmed, and this, he was buried. So the Gemara says, no, he quotes a Pasuk. The Pasuk talks about kids, grandkids. The Gemara says, if Yaakov's kids and grandkids are living, so it's like Yaakov's living. That's what the Gemara says. It's a beautiful Gemara. So the idea is Masorah, that if a person's children and grandchildren carry on their ideals and their approach to life, so in a sense, that person what? Never dies. And that's exactly what the Gemara is saying about Yaakov. Yaakov, this is Pashup Shah. Yaakov did die, but because his descendants lived on according to his approach with his ideals, so in a sense, in a very real sense, Yaakov never died. Yaakov being a Romans. So it always bothered me that we don't find such a Gemara or a Medrash about Avraham and Yitzchak. You only find it about Yaakov. So the answer is because by Avraham Yitzchak the Torah says Vayikva Vayamas, and by Yaakov it never says Vayamas. Okay, fine, but so, but that begs the question. So how come the Torah only by Yaakov suddenly doesn't say Vayamas? It says it by Avraham Yitzchak. Why Yaakov? Why Avraham also, Avraham's grandkids also were from. And, I mean, the idea of Masorah applies to all the Avos. Why dafka by Yaakov do we find such a Gemara? So I think based on what the Rav said, you could say as follows. Exactly what we just said. Yaakov is the ultimate symbol of the Masorah. So if you have to choose one of the Avos to make this point, that when a person's descendants live on according to their approach to life, with their ideals, it's as if the person never died. Who do you choose? Which of the Avos would you choose to make that point, to emphasize that point, to teach that to Yisod? Yaakov. So I think it fits beautifully, it fits perfectly, that the of the three Avos, that the Gemara says, he dafka never died, it's dafka Yaakov. Because Yaakov is the ultimate symbol of the Masorah. Rav Soloveitchik said that he experienced this idea of bridging the generation gap and connecting through the Masorah not only to one but two generations. He experienced it himself. That he gave shiur from being a young man till he was very old. And there were times, even as an old man in his 70s and 80s, where he was giving shiur to boys who were literally young enough to be his grandchildren. And this idea of bridging the generation gap and experiencing the Masorah with people like your grandchildren he experienced himself. And he went further and he explained as follows. He explained this based on the Mishnah, that once you go past, Masorah means father to son. Once you get past that basic biological relationship, or rather it's, whoever's teaching you Torah, so then there's really no end. It's like a young boy sees his grandfather, teaches him Torah, and the grandfather's quoting his teachers, his Rebbeim. So the boy feels, that's the Masorah. He's my grandfather. He's not my father, he's my grandfather, a very old man. And he's quoting his other names to me, and that's his Masorah, so now that's my Masorah. And the idea of spanning generations, that a Jew feels that they're not only living in the present with their father, with their grandfather, but a Jew feels they're living as part of this living historical Masorah. That's really the message of, that's what Masorah means. Masorah means that we're living nowadays. It's based on what our grandfathers told us, which is based on what their Rebbeim told them, which is based on their Rebbeim and their Rebbeim and their Rebbeim, all the way back to the Rishonim, to Rabbi Akiva, back to the Tanoim, back to Moshe Rabbeinu. So once you focus on the concept of Masorah, and you feel you're living it, then you're not limited to who's ever alive nowadays. Masorah means, I am part of this Masorah. So that idea of the extended Masorah, that when you're teaching Torah to someone, you feel it's not just you and them, but it's you as representing the whole Masorah, teaching to them, that also, the Rav described how he experienced that in his when he gave Shir. And he described that, and that is on tape. So we're going to play the tape now. This is the Rav describing himself giving Shir. And you can read along. You can read along with, read along. It's hard to follow the English, but if you read along, it's more or less goes along and you'll be able to follow.
But whatever I said now is not just an idea. To me, it's an experience. Let me say that the secret of Mis Paraderes of combining, uniting, merging many generations into one community, that the strategy of peace disappeared. Over years played no role, centuries have had no significance. Where generations, I mean, and so to say, communicate with each other. I do experience every time I enter the classroom, and if I've been a teacher for the last, how many years? For the last minute, you make it very old. Whenever I enter the classroom, which is crowded with boys, it could be as far as age is concerned, my grandchildren, I enter the classroom as an old man, a mom, with a wrinkled face and eyes reflecting fatigue and the sadness of old age. You have to be old in order to experience that sadness. It's a very strange sadness. It's the melancholy of things, of memory, of remembering things. Things will disappear. Don't exist. When I enter a classroom, I sit down, and opposite me, rows of boys, young boys, with beaming eyes, beaming faces, clear eyes, radiating the joy of being young. Always when I enter, I enter in a very pessimistic mood. I always enter the class in despair. And I ask myself, every time I enter the classroom, can there be a dialogue between an old teacher and young students? Between a rabbi in his Indian summer and boys enjoying the spring of their lives? I start here. I don't know what the conclusion is. Whenever I started here, the door opens, another old man walks in and sits down. He is older than I am. Oh, the Talmudim told me the Rav, he is older than I am. Right? He's the great, the grandfather of the Rav. His name is Rav Chaim Brisker. Without whom, no shiur can be doing it nowadays. Then the door opens quietly again, and another old man comes in. He's older than Rav Chaim. He lived in the 17th century. What's his name? Shabtai Cohen, the famous Shach, who must be present when phenomena are being discussed. And we study about Mitzvah, about the coming. But, and then more visitors show up. Some of the visitors lived in the 11th century, some in the 12th century, some in the 13th century, some lived in antiquity. Rabbi Akiva, Rashi, Rabbi Nadav, the Rayet, the Rashbo. More and more tapir coming. Of course, what do I do? I introduce them to my pupils. And the dialogue commences. The Rambam says something, the Rayet disagrees. Sometimes it's very nasty. Very sharp. How strong that he uses against the Rayet. A boy jumps up to defend the Rambam against the Rayet. And a boy is fresh, young boys are fresh. So the language he uses is improper, he uses improper language, so I correct him. And another boy jumps up with a new idea. The Rashbo smiles gently. I try to analyze what the young boy meant. Another boy intervenes. We call upon the Rabbi Natan to express his opinion. And suddenly, a symposium of generations comes into existence. Generations! Young boys, 22, 23, 24 years of age. Our boys are just 18 years old, are in my class. One generation, then my generation, then the generation of Chaim Brisker, then the generation of the Shah, then the generation of the Rashbo, the Rambam, the generation of the Rambam, the generation of Rashi, the generation of the Rabbi Natan, and then I mean there's one. What about Rav Heiberg? What about Rav Akiva? Rav Lezer, Rav Yechon Nesaka? All generations are now. We all speak one language. Particular at Sofa Achas Dvorim Acharim. We all chat, we all laugh, we all enjoy the company, and we all pursue one goal. We all are committed to a common vision, and we all operate in the same categories. There is Masera collegiality, friendship, comradeship between old and young, between antiquity, Middle Ages, and modern times. The rapids, this unity of generations, this march of centuries, this conversation of generations, this dialogue between antiquity and present, we will finally bring the redemption of the dream.
There's a part of the tape that's not printed here, so we'll just skip to this paragraph. Let me tell you, this is at the end of the shiur. Let me tell you, the Rav says, at the conclusion of the shiur, which can sometimes last 3 or 4, even 4 hours, I emerge young, younger than my pupils. They are tired and exhausted. I feel happy. I have defeated age. I feel young and rejuvenated. In the Masorah experience, years play no role. Hands, however parchment dry and wrinkled, embrace warm and supple hands in a commonality, bridging the gap which separates generations. This was the experience which people had in the Rav Shir. At a few things. Number one, the idea that when you were in Asalvechit Shir, you felt as if the Rishonim and the Tanoim were there with you was a living experience. When Rav Shechter spoke about Asalvechit, he said that the Rav Shir was so exciting and so emistic, for lack of a better word, and just so powerful, that you mamish felt as if the Tanaim and Amorim were in the room with you, and the Rishonim were there. Rav Shechter, when he described the Rav Shir, he said that the boys felt that the Malachi Asharis were coming down to hear Shir from the Rav, Shechter Zagadol, when the Rav gave Shir. The Rebbe used to give shiur on Tuesdays and Wednesdays for years. So the joke in YU was that we have Kriyas HaTorah on Mondays and Thursdays, and Kabbalas HaTorah on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. That's how Shechter described it, the boys felt. But this idea that when you're part of the Masorah community, years playing a role, what that means is the Rav viewed himself as part of this Masorah community. So he was just one in a very long line of the Tanoim, Amorim, Mishonim, and it's like they're giving shiur with him. So during the shiur, while he's giving shiur, the power of the Torah itself, the power of the Masorah, reinvigorated him. And the Rav, when he was an old man, would come into shiur, like he said, old, and the boys would see this every day. He could barely walk. He had back pains. And during the shiur, 2, 3, 4 hours, he suddenly comes to life. And the experience of seeing someone who, because he is a Baal Masorah, literally physically rejuvenated by the Torah, is something the boys saw every daily in the Rav shiur. I experienced this somewhat from the Rav's younger brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Shlita. He gave Parsha Shirim in YU for a few years that I was there. And he had a stroke already. And he could barely walk. He had lost most use of the left side of his body. And he walked with a heavy walker. He doesn't like being helped. He likes to do things on his own. And to walk, let's say, from that door to, let's say, from the door to the table here, would take him, I don't know, a minute. Which is an eternity. You know, for us it would take 3 seconds. And he would walk into the long room, breathing heavily, hunched over, and he'd start giving a shiur. And you would see in front of your eyes, I saw this weekly for several months, for 2 years really. He comes alive. He'd give a shiur 2, 3 hours. Shiur ends 10:15, and he could have gone for another 2 hours. I mean, you see it in front of your eyes. The person's part of the Masorah. The Torah itself gives you life. And like he would tell stories about Europe and about his father and his grandfather, what he saw in Europe, and he mentioned this gadol and that gadol that he saw when he grew up in Warsaw when he was a kid. And this experience of feeling you're part of the Masorah as you're in a shiur is something which I experienced somewhat with Avraham Soloveitchik. So this is the idea of Yaakov's life. Yaakov is the ultimate Isha Masorah, that it's not just one generation, but two. And once it's two, that means you're not limited by biology. It just keeps on going back until the founders of the Masorah themselves, back to Hashem ultimately. So that's the idea which Yaakov represents, and that's the idea which Rav Soloveitchik, the boys in the shiur experience, and which he described in this shiur. This shiur the Rav gave in 1974, he was 71, at a Pidgin HaBen. Now at the Pidgin HaBen, the baby's father at that time was in the Rav shiur. And the baby's grandfather had been in the Rav shiur in the 40s, you know, 30 years earlier. And during the Rav's speech, he took out a letter from the baby's grandfather's grandfather. And in that letter, the grandfather's grandfather wrote to the Rav in the 1940s, "Watch my grandson for me, tell me how he's doing, keep me updated on my grandson's progress." So the Rav felt he had a four-generational connection to this baby. The father was in shiur, the grandfather had been in shiur, and the grandfather's grandfather had written him a letter which he had kept about the grandfather. So it was in that context that he spoke about the Masorah. So I have personal reasons why I give the shiur over in Parshas Vayechi, because 5 years ago my grandmother Leah Shalom was nifter during the Parshas. I want to spend a few minutes discussing my grandmother. Grandmother was a very special, talented, multi-talented, very active person. I have a friend who once said, "Your grandmother was a doer," and doer is the right word to describe my grandmother. First of all, she loved to learn, always interested in, and especially lots of chumash, very interested in learning chumash. And she used to come to my parents' seder. At our seder, she always had interest in Divrei Torah. We used to argue sometimes, but interest in Divrei Torah to say, and she's always very interested and very always inquisitive about learning Mamasha her whole life. When she was younger, so the my great grandfather hired a Malamed for his kids, and my grandmother would go and sit there with them. So she would sit there. They'd learn Mishnayos and Gemara. She was always interested. And she won't come out a lot better than her brothers did. There's a book that Rav Palk has in his house, a sefer, written by Chasam Talmud Chacham, where he quotes, this Talmud Chacham quotes Leah Rosenson as giving a very complex little vort in the Mishnah and Sota, or Sanhedrin. Rav Palk has a book in his house. It's my grandmother. And when she got older, she didn't do this. But when she was younger, that's what she was learning, because she sat with the Melamed. And she said a vort in a piece of Gemara, which is printed up in a sefer, a podcast of sefer. She was just an excellent, excellent speaker. It was almost impossible to find someone who was a better speaker than my grandmother. She would speak at every family simcha. She was a darshan. She would take a pasuk. Basically, she would take a pasuk or a phrase in the parsha, the Haftorah, and she would build some theme that relates to the simcha from that pasuk, or from that pasuk. So much like we got married between Kiketze and Kisava. So she spoke at our wedding, you know, Kisetze, what are you taking out as you're leaving your home? And Kisava, what are you, meaning what did I bring from my parents' home? Kisetze, I'm leaving my parents' home. What am I taking with me? And Kisava, what am I hoping to bring into my new home? That was her style of Jewish. Very, very, I told you she should be a mashkiach. She had the potential to be a very good mashkiach. She also often was the major speaker, the person who gave the Dvar Torah at many events. We'll get to later. She was involved in like the Federation. There were many different events where she was an Orthodox Reform Conservative event, and she was the representative of the Orthodox. She gave the Dvar Torah, and she had a way of giving a really very Orthodox, traditional Dvar Torah. And everyone listened. Everyone was happy. And she had this way about her of being able to say what people needed to hear and say things very well. That's two. Three, she was very active in communal affairs in several ways. Number one, she was very active in shuls for her whole life. When she was younger, she was part of the building of the Chicago Orthodox community, and she lived in Chicago, and this, where they lived, so when an Orthodox shul started, the shuls in the neighborhood were mostly conservative at the time. So when she was a teenager, she would drive around on Sunday mornings to get men to go to minyan, because it was important to have minyan every day in shul. That's the mesova, and if an Orthodox shul doesn't have minyan every day, Sunday's a rough time. People are in bed, they're lazy, whatever. When you're going to work anyways, so she would drive the minyan carpool Sunday mornings to bring the men to shul to make sure there's a minyan every day in the small, just born Orthodox shul in her neighborhood. When she got older, she was very active in the shul where she lived in the north side of Chicago later in her life. She would write the Dibrei Torah for the shul bulletin, and she was very involved in the shul. Her shul was in what we would call a very modern neighborhood, and the reason why the shul remained Orthodox and is Orthodox still is primarily due to her influence, her personal influence. And she said, you know, she's not her daven, not an Orthodox shul. So, like my brothers and I would daven in her shul, and we were able to daven there because it was Orthodox primarily due to her. Four, she was heavily involved in Jewish education. She gave a lot of her money and her time, obviously, in the supporting education. She was a major supporter of the yeshiva in Chicago, Skokie. She was the first woman to receive an honorary degree from them, from Skokie. And she was a major, major force in pushing a woman's education in America. When she was Nifter, Rav Moshe Gottesman, he's the head of Hank. So he called an assembly in his school to make sure people knew the influence my grandmother had on education in America. Rav Moshe Gottesman grew up in Chicago in my great-grandparents' home. He spent a lot of time there. And to know that the influence of pushing women's education throughout the country, my grandmother played a major role. At our Seder, she always made sure that the women spoke up as well. My sister, my cousins, you know, you have enough too, you know, not only the boys. And she was a big pusher that women, they should learn and say things as well. Four or five, she was a major, major leading religious Zionist in Chicago in the 50s and 60s and 70s. She supported Eretz Yisrael, Medina Yisrael. They built yeshivas here. My family, my grandmother and my grandfather, they built yeshivas here. In Netanya, there's a yeshivas B'nai Akiva. If you walk in there, all the names there on the back and the different rooms, there's Lavin, and Rosenson, that's my family name. The person I named after, Benjamin Lavin, one of the rooms in that yeshiva B'nai Akiva Netanya is my name, that they built the yeshiva Netanya. She was heavily involved in the federations. but the UJA basically to collect a lot of money in America and send it to Israel. And most of the American Jews aren't Orthodox. And most of the money that in America that goes to Israel goes to Orthodox schools. So how did that happen? So my grandmother for many years was the only Orthodox member of the special board that decides where the money goes. She was the only Orthodox member, and it was her job to explain why the money should go to Orthodox causes, because, you know, the yeshivas here that need it most, and that they're the ones really carrying on the Masorah. And for years, that was her job, to defend Orthodoxy in Israel versus Reform Conservative. And it was a very special person. But the reason why I'm telling you this story, this my grandmother now, part of this Dvar Torah, is because with all of these things she did, and active and doing, and talents and everything she did, this public speaking, to all of us in the family, she was grandma. And she was such a wonderful grandmother on a personal, private level. She gave each one of her grandchildren exactly what they needed, either chizuk or guidance. And all of us knew that, like, she was the matriarch of the family. And, you know, when big things happened in the family, you know, she was the one, you know, to go to. You know, whenever you got engaged, you know, the most important test was, you know, would grandma like her or not. That was the most important, or him, you know, if you're a girl. The most important test was, you know, what a grandma think. And she had an amazing ability. It's really amazing. Like, this is, it's funny, but it's really true. Each one of us thought we were the favorite, most special grandchild. I for sure thought I was. She would call me from Chicago to discuss her parsha words that she's writing, her show bulletin. I said, you know, calling me from Chicago, you know, she could have called my other cousins. She called me. I thought I was the most special one. And then I find out later at the Levaya, my cousin learned in Skokie, and his friends made fun of him. He had the oldest chavrusa in the yeshiva, because once a week he'd learn with my grandmother on the phone, you know, from the yeshiva. And my you know, all my grandmother's grandchildren are fully, heavily, seriously Orthodox, which is not so common coming from Chicago in the 1960s and 70s, and she's very proud of that. There's a secular Jewish writer in the 19th century who used to say that halakhically, if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish. But a better definition of if you're really a solid Jew is whether your grandchildren are Jewish. My grandmother used to like to quote that all the time, that voice. I'm not sure whoever said it, somebody said it. And it's a very important idea, and it's very important to remember that Judaism comes down to the Masorah. Whatever you're involved in outside, people are involved in different things outside, working, whatever, but the Masorah, and being a Baal Masorah, I view my grandmother as a tremendous Baal Masorah in our family. Being a Baal Masorah, that's the crucial element of what Yahadus is all about. That's what Yaakov symbolized, that's what the Rav experienced, and that's what my grandmother was for us. Just to close, this last little word comes from Chana, the secretary. I'm not sure what her last name is. It used to be Ben Chaim. Chana, the secretary. So I gave this Dvar Torah in Shevach 6 years ago. She was in 12th grade. And she said as follows, that the topic of this week's parsha is Yaakov's death. And yet the name of the parsha is Vayechi Yaakov. And I think it's not a coincidence that the entire theme, the entire story of Yaakov's death, we remember as Vayechi Yaakov, which is exactly the point. As Yaakov's dying, he's not dying. Yaakov was teaching Torah to Menashe and Ephraim. He was passing along the Masorah to the second generation. He never died. Yaakov never died. Vayechi Yaakov. Yaakov's death is called for Ol Mayad, Yolam Boed, Vayechi Yaakov. And, you know, Yaakov never died in a sense. I feel in a very real sense, my grandmother is, in a very real sense, is still alive in that sense. And that's really the theme of this week's parsha, that even as Yaakov's dying, the theme, the name, the title of the parsha that sticks with us is Vayechi Yaakov. When you're in the Masorah, when you're part of the Masorah, then, in a sense, you never die, because your ideals continue even after your physical death. And that's the, I think, the main theme of Parshas Vayechi, that is the Masorah. Okay, we'll stop.